Good evening. My name is Hannah Hutton, and I am a member of the student board at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to welcome you to tonight's event, Euthanasia: Whose Right to Die Is It? Euthanasia refers to the practice of ending a person's life painlessly and has become synonymous with physician-assisted suicide, in which a patient is provided with the means to commit suicide. Euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide remain highly controversial, raising the age-old question of who owns the rights to your body into the minds of those dealing with end-of-life issues. In 1992, a Canadian woman suffering from Lou Gehrig's disease fought for her legal right to die in all the way to the Canadian Supreme Court, asking judges, "If I cannot give consent to my own death, whose body is this? Who owns my life?" However, the Canadian High Court denied her the right to end her own life. The tension between the state's interest in preserving human life and the individual's right to end it remains intense. Physician-assisted suicide has only been legalized in 3 U.S. states, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, and 7 countries: Switzerland, the Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, Norway, Sweden, and Albania. To help us understand the issues related to euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, the Clark Forum has organized a panel of experts and experienced professionals. The panelists are Dr. Greg Lewis, registered nurse Linda Smith, Carol Ponish, and Professor James Heffler. Dr. Greg Lewis graduated from the University of Pennsylvania and is currently a gastroenterologist at the Carlisle Digestive Disease Associates. He has taught several courses on biomedical ethics at Dickinson College and served for nearly 2 decades as the chair of the Carlisle Regional Medical Center's Biomedical Ethics Committee. He recently earned a master's degree in philosophy to accompany his medical credentials. Linda Smith has practiced in the medical field as a registered nurse for 39 years and served as hospice director for Comfort Care Hospice from 1997 to 2001. She focuses primarily on end-of-life issues, and her personal goal is to help patients realize that interpersonal healing and wholeness can happen even in the face of death. In 1998, Carol Ponish's mother, Marion Frederick, became Dr. Kevorkian's 19th patient who died with his assistance. Jack Kevorkian was later charged with murder for his involvement in Marion Friedrich's death. Since then, Carol Ponish founded Marion's Friends, an organization dedicated to legalizing physician-assisted suicide. Currently, she is assisting with the production of a documentary on the subject, Last Rites: Facing End-of-Death Choices. She holds a master's degree in public health from Indiana University and has debated the issue of assisted suicide nationally and internationally. Serving as moderator this evening is Professor James Heffler of the Political Science and Policy Management Departments at Dickinson College. Professor Heffler's current research focuses on end-of-life decision-making and the right to die. He specializes in American politics, with particular emphasis in public policy analysis, state and local government, and public administration. At this time, I would like to remind you to please turn off all cell phones and pagers. Also, since this program is being taped and some of our audience members may be hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking a question during the question and answer session at the end of the program. Immediately following the program this evening, there will be a continuing the conversation session in room 102, next door. This will be an informal discussion about the program, and all are welcome. Now please join me in welcoming our panelists.
Hi all, thanks for coming out. I really appreciate, I think we all do, your interest in this topic. I have a couple of things to do before we turn to the panelists. First of all, I just wanted to refer to the sheet that everybody has. Hopefully this will just give you a little bit of a mind map. Please don't try to read it now. It's a lot of words on there, but it's a takeaway parting gift, if you will, to take with you to reference back when you're thinking about these issues. And there are really 4 kinds of things that get merged into this idea of the right to die, and we're going to talk about physician-assisted suicide tonight, but I want to locate all four of them for you so you get a sense for what we're talking about. One of the things you see listed on the chart, it says foregoing treatment. And since 1990, the AMA and all of the major medical associations, the Supreme Court, and all of the states have pretty much recognized the right to forego medical treatment at the end of life, regardless of what it is. So life-sustaining medical treatment, it doesn't matter what it is. It could be something as simple as food and fluids. You can forego that at the end of life. That's a constitutionally protected right. That's not what we're talking about tonight. The second thing you see there is assisted suicide. That's what we are talking about tonight. That's where a physician typically, but not always, physician will prescribe an overdose of medication to a terminally ill patient who goes on at the time he or she chooses to take that medication at the end of life and to end their life. That's physician-assisted suicide. Euthanasia, although it means in general good death, it's from the Greek eu and thanos, eu meaning good, thanos meaning death, typically, at least in this country, is used to mean that a physician will actually inject the patient with a dose of lethal medication, and it's sometimes referred to as mercy killing. It's a much more proactive approach than assisted suicide. That's what euthanasia is. The last thing, and we're going to see a video clip, there's actually on NPR this morning, very timely, it's called palliative sedation. For people at the end of life who have a lot of symptomology that can't be managed in any other way, you use a variety of different drugs, sometimes morphine, more typically benzodiazepine drugs in that family, to sedate the person to the point of unconsciousness if necessary, and then ultimately they pass away shortly thereafter. The point here is the doctor is not killing the patient as in euthanasia. The doctor is taking extraordinary measures to manage the symptoms. That means putting the patient in a state of unconsciousness. And typically two to three days, in most cases, they die. So we'll watch this video in a second. Before I do that, I did want to thank my three panelists in advance before we turn to them. They're very special people, each in their own way. I've never said this to Greg, but Greg Lewis here in the middle, if I go out and get hit by a bus on a high street out here, I'm putting Greg in charge of all of my medical care. So I want you to know that you are in charge. And he's that kind of doctor I have so much faith in. And sitting to the right of him, Linda, when Greg says there's nothing more we can do for this guy, Linda's retired, but you're in charge at that point, right? So I've already picked you out in retirement, so I hope you can handle the guilt, you know. So I hope you don't say no when the time comes. And the other person here is a very, very special friend, Carol Ponish, who's closest to me, who flew in from Detroit yesterday to do this program with us. I feel very guilty about introducing her all day to everybody I've run into, is the daughter of Jack Kevorkian's 19th patient. She's a very special person in her own right, and she's done an awful lot. She's faced a dilemma that none of us ever would hope to face. A mother who's seriously ill, who's having trouble managing her symptoms, and she did it with grace and dignity, and she's a very strong person. I'm so tickled that you were able to come be with us tonight. So thank you very much. Okay, without further ado, this first clip, it's about 4 minutes. It was on NPR this morning. I'll leave this up here and start the audio. This is about a woman who chose to die with dignity, and it, like I said, it ran this morning.
Next, we have a follow-up on a woman named Catherine Royce. She contributed an essay in 2006 for our series, This I Believe. She had been a dancer and a deputy arts commissioner for the city of Boston. Then in 2003, Catherine Royce was diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Here's NPR's Richard Knox with the rest of her story.
My friend and neighbor Catherine Royce died recently by choice. Choice was important to Catherine, as she said 2.5 years ago in her essay for NPR.
I believe that I always have a choice. No matter what I'm doing, no matter what is happening to me, I always have a choice.
There's a deep irony here. Catherine certainly didn't choose to get ALS. and she had no choice as she lost her ability to walk, to feed herself, to talk above a whisper, and lately to breathe without sucking on an oxygen tube every 15 seconds or so. As the losses mounted, Catherine considered again and again whether to choose life. As she said in 2006,
"Every day I choose not only how I will live, but if I will live. I have no particular religious mandate that forbids contemplating a shorter life, an action that would deny this disease its ultimate expression."
But until this spring, Catherine kept finding reasons to live. As she put it, she opened herself to other possibilities.
"I can choose to see ALS as nothing more than a death sentence, or I can choose to see it as an invitation, an opportunity to learn who I truly am."
She poured out those insights in a series of essays that she got to see published a few months ago in a book she called Wherever I Am, I'm Fine. But as breathing got more difficult, Catherine became anxious and frightened of dying. That is, until an event that happened a couple of months ago. A nurse was filling the vaporizer on Catherine's oxygen machine. Something went wrong. The machine shut down. Soon, three nurses were in the room frantically trying to restart it. They couldn't hear Catherine's feeble voice. She tried to tell them she was running out of breath, that they should hook up the spare machine. She was insane with fear, she said later, and knew the game was up. Then she experienced something others have described at the threshold of death. "The scene behind my closed eyes was filled with a brilliant white corridor featuring a right-hand turn at the end," she wrote in her blog. "Feeling curious and no longer afraid, I started to walk down the corridor, no wheelchairs here. At that point, I heard one of the nurses say, 'There it goes.' The machine started up again. Catherine was pulled back to life. After that, she wasn't afraid anymore. She began planning her death, a deliberate one, not one that would occur because a machine suddenly broke down. It wasn't easy to arrange. Some around her felt strongly it was wrong and told her so. A lawyer for the nursing home was consulted. He said in this case it would not be euthanasia, which is illegal in Massachusetts, because no one would be injecting a drug to cause her death. Instead, the oxygen would be gradually turned down while a morphine drip would keep Catherine comfortable and calm. She would simply be putting aside the technology that kept her tethered to life. Catherine chose the time. It was when her daughter Galen could come home from England, where she's studying medicine. On the appointed morning, her loved ones gathered. Catherine was aware and engaged during the two-hour process. Eventually, she dozed off. And here let me quote again from her last essay. "What can I tell you about the bright light? It really is there. I saw it. I can in no way guarantee that you will see one too, or that I will see one again. But I hope we are all so blessed."
That's NPR's Richard Knox, remembering his friend Catherine Royce. She died March 30th at the age of 60. You can listen to her essay, this, I believe, at NPR.org.
Okay, so that's an example of withholding treatment with a tinge of palliative sedation, where she was sedated heavily at the end of life. It wasn't euthanasia, and that's not what we're talking about tonight, but that's one alternative for people in this condition. The second video clip is about 4 minutes also, and it'll introduce those of you who are below 25 or so to Jack Kevorkian, who you may not know or even recognize that name, but those of us who are a little bit older, he's really a cultural phenomenon for many years. So I wanted to make sure everybody in the audience just got a sense for this person and his moment and his passion for this cause, and it'll end up with a short video clip from the documentary that is being made partly about Carol's mom, Marion. So you'll see Carol, and then we'll transition right to Carol. So here we go. It's a little grainy. This is Dr. Dean. I don't know if anybody knows this guy, but he runs a daily program on, or did for years out of the West Coast, and this is a clip from his program.
Thank you. My first guest is Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Dr. Kevorkian has become one of the most controversial figures in medicine since June of 1990, when he helped Janet Adkins, who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease, kill herself. Since then, he has helped three more gravely ill women end their lives. In those three cases, he was charged with murder. The last of those charges were recently dismissed. They call you Dr. Death, they call you Dr. Doom. This isn't what you went to medical school for, I'm sure. How did you ever get started in this? What began this process for you?
Doctor has three missions in life. Mm-hmm. Using his expertise, knowledge, and training and ability to the best of his ability, he is to prolong life as much as possible. As long as the health warrants it, he's to maintain the health also. That's the second. And the third is to alleviate or curtail suffering. Now, we have de-emphasized the third one in our society. It's still a doctor's duty.
Now, your wife had severe pelvic pain. She had a series of operations trying to figure out what was wrong with her. Not sure they ever did. Tell me about her illness. How much pain was she in? What was it like?
Well, she was in pain that no amount of medicine, including morphine or the legal dose of morphine is, I don't know exactly, but she was taking four times that dose by one doctor and still wasn't getting rid of the pain.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kevorkian, so she went to a good specialist, she went to the best, we both know how many times, you know, they turn out not to have the answer. You really feel in your heart of hearts secure with this? This was your wife, for instance. Would you have given up at that point? Every avenue had been explored?
Yeah, so the pain specialist was the top man in this area, and he admitted on communication, I think it was a television show, he admitted openly he couldn't help her.
Yeah, he's one doctor, though.
I decided that I had to do something to help this woman who was screaming in pain so loud that the neighbors could hear it.
Wouldn't a more logical thing at that point have been a second opinion? We're always telling people get a second opinion. Another world-class pain specialist.
Yes, there were 10 operations, Dr. Mm-hmm. Dean. At some point, she has a right to decide enough is enough.
Most physicians, frankly, we do a lousy job managing pain. And it scares me to think that people could make a decision like this without availing themselves of the best possible medical care. Suicide could be a frighteningly terrible mistake, a permanent, irreversible one. So if there's any margin of error at all, which there almost always is in medicine, this is just not a tenable idea. In every medical decision, you have to balance what you stand to gain versus what you stand to lose. In this case, what you stand to gain is nebulous at best. What you stand to lose is everything.
I drove up to my mother's house one day, and there was a car in front of my mother's house, and it had a bumper sticker. It said something about Jack Kevorkian. It said, had enough, you know, call Jack.
I think Kevorkian was sort of a societal phenomenon.
Twice now, Dr. Jack Kevorkian used his
more widespread public.
One poll taken about 1994 showed that, with the single exception of the President of the United States, more people knew who Jack Kevorkian was than any other figure, living or dead. Amazing.
She wrote a long letter explaining why she was going to go to Dr. Jack Kevorkian and what her criteria were and what her reasons were, and that she still loved us and please don't take it personally. And so the rest of the people in the room had to go around and nod their head and say, yes, we understand, that's what she wants. And then it came to me.
Carol.
And I choked. I just couldn't do it. It's what she wanted. And I'm sure that even what happened after her death, all the politics probably would have made her happy, you know, that maybe she may have contributed in some way to something that she believed in.
For your time, for a moment you were mine.
Carol?
Okay. Is this live? That's good. Everybody can hear? The other room can hear too? Oh, good. But you can't see us, right? Do they have a...
Oh, they're watching video.
Oh, they're watching the...
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Smile.
All right. yeah, it was 15 years ago, actually, that my mother was helped by Dr. Jack Kevorkian to breathe carbon monoxide. Actually, she did the work herself. She released a paper clip on a tube, and she had a mask on that enabled her to... Well, that she breathed the gas, and within 20 minutes, she... Well, during that time, she fell asleep, became drowsy, fell asleep, and passed away. A week after she died, we were brought into, Jack was brought into a courtroom, municipal courtroom, to see if there was enough evidence to try him for murder for my mother's death. And at that time, he was going through a starvation protest. He's all about theater and getting his name, getting his ideas across. And so he, they didn't bring him to trial right then, but it was a couple years later that they tried to, well, they brought him to trial for murder in my mother's case, and actually there was five different patients of his. The state of Michigan was, and the prosecutors in Michigan were very frustrated with Jack just continually dropping bodies off at the hospital and saying, here you go, please arrest me. You know, he really wanted them to make a public issue out of this and debate it in the courtroom, hopefully making it legal through a court case. And so when I, you know, was totally not ready for this, not ready for the theater that he, that Kevorkian and his attorney, Jeffrey Feiger, wanted. Plus, you know, there was grieving to go on, and it was a difficult time to, trying to sort out what my feelings were versus what, you know, the public was screaming about. He actually had four trials, and the last one put him in jail for 8 years. The but since she died, I've been very willing to speak out in defense of my mother's decision, in defense of who she was, that she made a rational decision. I firmly believe that. The disease that she has, that you saw this woman had, was the same thing where she lost her speech, lost swallowing, lost, was losing breathing, losing everything, to the point where she knew that the last thing she would have would be eye movements. Now, Stephen Hawking, a famous physicist from Caltech, is able to live with the same disease. He has, you know, a very strong will, and my mother even read his book right away when she found out what she had, and wanted to understand how could this one individual live so long. And, you know, if you're patient enough and you get enough medical attention, if you have enough energy, you could live a very long time. But in my mother's case, she almost choked to death a couple times. Just she was living alone. I lived a half hour away. I was trying to get to her house every day, sometimes twice a day, with two small children in tow. And she saw the strain it was putting on me, but she didn't know that I had this instinct to try to keep her alive. I had this feeling like she was drowning and I needed to save her. And I had an ego that was huge, and I thought, I'm going to save her life. I'm going to keep her alive for not only for myself, but for my children and my sisters and brothers. And so I continued to, I tried to problem solve. I said, well, we're going to work on your, she couldn't hold her head up. You know, people in the room and her head was always like this. And so I tried to help her get some kind of neck support, very difficult because she didn't want to leave the house. And, you know, as we know, American physicians don't make house calls. And so, but she did take oxygen at the end just because she knew that she was going to get help to die, and she was willing to prolong her life a little bit so that we could all get into town. My sisters and brothers lived out of state. And so the disease kind of, you know, was a cocoon. It kind of, like, wrapped around her and made her so that she couldn't talk or she couldn't even express her feelings. If she was hungry and we were putting, you know, food into her tube, or she had a gastric tube, or if she was full, you know, she was afraid that, you know, they'd be feeding her too much, or that when there were times when she would have, she'd be uncomfortable lying in bed, like an arm would get stuck under her, and she wouldn't be able to tell anybody, please do this for me because it's killing me, it's hurting me. So it's just a very fearful disease, and I think a lot of patients who do, as you'll hear from our hospice nurse, find out that they will be able to end their suffering. They are very relieved and very happy that they will have control over their lives, which you know, my mother certainly had no control other than that. Working in with this in this activity, or supporting physician aid in dying, being an advocate for it. I've gotten letters from people. I've heard a lot of stories about people who've been helped to die in hospitals by kind physicians who are willing to go against the law. When my mother died, there was a law against physician aid in dying in the legislature, and actually Kevorkian was prohibited from, he had sworn that he would not help anybody, but he did help my mom regardless. So when we went to trial a couple years later in a larger circuit court, the whole defense was all about, there was no intent to murder my mother, and by the way, it still says murder on her death certificate. The only intent was to relieve her suffering, and those of us who were near her knew that she was suffering. Her hospice nurse came and when she came, she had a big cross. She wore a big cross, and we knew she was very religious and made reference to religion and also made it clear that she would not help my mother to die. And that's part of the reason that my mother did go to Kevorkian. And, you know, had we had a choice to switch nurses, no, there was no way, because we loved this nurse. There was nobody that was more caring and understanding of what she was going through. And after going through the trials, I mean, there was three to four trials, so I tried to participate, support the other patients of Dr. Kevorkian's, and we had a tight network of family members. We called ourselves the survivors, and we would get together and have potlucks with the attorney and with Jack, and there seemed to be a common thread amongst all of us that we had difficulty, obstacles, roadblocks. For example, I heard a story about somebody on a hospital wing where a nurse was just crying wolf. That person wants to die. And then all of a sudden, they didn't have that option open to them anymore. So the issue of physician aid in dying to me is valid in a very small number of cases, very few. But I think the people who oppose it are fearful that it will be a slippery slope and that we're advocating death. And I think that it's more important to advocate care for people at the end of life, give people more options. And, you know, it's a fine line between giving up your life when you're worrying about so many things. You're worrying about being a burden to your family, and you're being worried about your own feelings about how much suffering and pain you'd be willing to go through just for them. So it's a discussion that it's a really difficult discussion that's very private, doesn't belong in courtrooms or in the newspapers, certainly. But it's a privacy thing that there's something about wanting not. My mother needed to be cleaned up, showering and cleaning, bathrooming, and that was, I think that was one of the most difficult things for her. And I'm not sure what solutions are to that. Certainly, we need more care for dying patients. But let's see. There's also the issue of money, and that always comes up in this argument, like, oh, there's, if you legalize it, then there'll be grandchildren that'll be wanting to, knock off their grandmother to get the inheritance sooner. Well, there is an argument for that, and there's, any time that you have possibility for abuse, that doesn't mean that you can't allow it. For it to be used. I think that, Madoff abused the banking system, but that doesn't mean what he did, what the work he was in was wrong. So we can't just stop allowing people to die to end their suffering. So I think that, on the other hand, I got a long letter from somebody who talked about patients in hospitals who don't have family members who are kept alive just to keep that bed occupied, And sometimes it can be a very inexpensive way of income for a hospital to just to keep that feeding tube filled and keeping the person turning, and so that income is a steady income. There are doctors, I mentioned, that do help patients die in hospitals, starvation, dehydration, with some morphine and a little additional morphine. And I find that I hear about them because I advocate for this, and I also know that I was in a debate with one of our state senators in Michigan on a TV station, and back in the green room, I said to him, don't you think that this is happening all the time anyway? He said, no, it's not happening at all. And I thought, how could that guy lie? How could he not, say that? And later I realized he said that because probably nobody will come up to him and admit that they helped, that they know somebody who was helped to die, because he doesn't want to hear it. That wasn't what he's advocating. So I really think that it does need to be regulated, because the reason I believe that is because there's always going to be people who are going to try to deregulate or to make it illegal. So there needs to be some safeguards. I think a way to do it is make sure that the person is terminally ill and make sure that all other help has been given to the patient. All of us are going to probably, or 80% of us are going to live a long, protracted illness, and medical science has really increased our ability to live longer on machines. And so this is going to be an issue that I hope in the future, and I won't predict if it'll be 10, 20, 30 years when it could be legalized, but I hope that we can look back and say, how could we have ever ignored this for people, sort of like interracial marriages used to be illegal, and I hope we can look back and say marriages between same-sex marriages, I'm hoping those will be legal too, just like there used to be. It was very difficult getting people to not allow withdrawing treatment, that was giving up on life, that you had to give treatment. So I'm hoping that, someday people will understand. Thank you very much.
I'd like to thank Dickinson and the Clark Center for allowing me to discuss this very charged topic of physician-assisted suicide and euthanasia. I feel for Carol's agonizing dilemma of 14, 15 years ago. Many people, when I was practicing medicine in the 80s and the 90s, who had terminally ill loved ones, faced different options, I think, than we do today. Pain control was not very good. The use of sedation was not very good. The recognition of the root of a patient's suffering was hard to come by. What I would hope to tell you today is that we have made great strides in medicine, and that the number of people who have to face that same agonizing dilemma, I think, are very few. But I will point out at the end of my discussion where I think the problems are with what diseases and what conditions, and where physicians do fall down, because we're not perfect and we do fall down under certain circumstances. As far as surveys of physicians concerning assisted suicide, about half of physicians, when they're surveyed, feel it's ethically justified in certain cases. And these surveys have shown that 1 in 5 physicians during their career will receive a request for assisted suicide from a patient. And that sometime in their career, 5 to 20% of physicians will honor that request. Now, when the general public is surveyed, most feel that assisted suicide is ethically justifiable in certain cases, and those certain cases are usually involving unrelenting suffering. And so one of the focuses of my brief presentation today is suffering and how important it is to dissect that word and see exactly what it means to a family and to a patient who's dying. Now, I've had patients come to me and request assisted suicide. And so what is my response? And what should any physician's response be when this request comes to them? Well, let me give you some general guidelines of what I think myself and most physicians in this area think should happen. One, we should try to find what the patient's motive is. Why are they asking that? And we should try to define why they're suffering. And we want to discern whether they have physical symptoms that make them request assisted suicide, such as pain, shortness of breath, or are there emotional symptoms that are making them give this request? Are they worried about loss of self-control, loss of dignity, being a burden to their families? It's important that we just don't listen to a patient and act on it without gathering more information. We want to know whether the patient has a psychosocial support system. Do they live by themselves? Do they have a sibling, a spouse, a parent, a child, anyone that's there for them? Because certainly one's suffering is much more intense if they don't have a strong psychosocial support system. So we got to really find that out. Other things that are important, is the diagnosis correct on this patient? In the literature, it's not that rare that one physician will tell a patient that they have a terminal condition that perhaps they don't really have, and that we would all react pretty similarly if we were convinced we had a terminal condition. I think it's important to make sure that the diagnosis is correct in the patients, but also their prognosis. As a patient, you may go to a physician and say, well, you have terminal cancer, you have 4 months to live. Now, obviously, our reaction as patients would be much different than if someone said, well, you have terminal cancer, you have 5 years to live. I think we would all live our lives much differently then. So it's important to sort out whether the diagnosis is correct and whether the prognosis is correct. And it's important that not just you as a doctor understand the disease process and all the psychosocial issues. Does the patient understand it? Do they have any misunderstanding about their diagnosis and their prognosis? That gives you a great chance to sit down with them and make sure they understand totally well the facts, because how can anyone, doctor, patient, family, begin a course of action without having the facts laid out in front of them? Let me just then tell you that those proponents of assisted suicide, as well as the opponents of assisted suicide, have the same goal, and it's to make sure that these terminally ill patients don't suffer. Suffering is what we're all about, not having our patients experience it. You didn't want your mother to suffer. I certainly don't want my patients to suffer. Now, the question is, how do you go about it, and what is suffering? Well, let's talk a little bit about suffering. In everyday life, we have our own idea of what suffering is. For instance, an elderly patient who's not had a bowel movement in 4 days. That's suffering to some patients. Something is simple. That's not a terminal disease, but in their own mind, they're suffering. A Dickinson College pre-med student who gets a C in organic chemistry. There's a lot of suffering right there, I can tell you. Okay? To terminally ill patients, though, suffering can be not just pain, not just the fear of shortness of breath, which is what we're talking about here, and loss of dignity, but loss of autonomy, and inability for one to control the final aspects of their life. To someone who's in control and then to revert to almost a childlike dependency on everyone else is very, very tough. To some terminally ill patients, their suffering is existential. Am I going to heaven when I die? Is there a God? Or they may ask practical questions. What's going to happen to my family when I die? Will my estate that I'm leaving to my family end up in the right hands? Other practical questions. Will I live with my disease to see my granddaughter graduate from high school? If you knew you so wanted to do that and you were going to die and not make it, in your own mind, that's suffering. Will I make my 50th wedding anniversary? If you knew you wouldn't live to it, there's suffering. So suffering is the elusive term that doctors try to sort out, and so they can try to help the patients at this point. So the bottom line is, in my mind, many patients who request physician-assisted suicide, they do so not always from pain or distress, but it's out of a fear that of what might happen to them. It's the fear of what could occur. And many people who have a terminal illness have previously seen loved ones or neighbors or friends die a miserable, suffering, painful death. And that conditions all of us because we don't want to die the same way. So automatically, when we're diagnosed with a terminal illness, we have preconditioned our own mind to think that we're going to die like some close friend just died. But a lot of those emotional feelings and psychological feelings that we're feeling at that time may have been under totally different conditions than ours, may have occurred 10 to 15 years ago when the advances of medicine weren't there, and the suffering may have been much different. So when I hear someone say they want to die, what they're saying is that they're looking to me for relief. They don't always want to die. They want a physician who can help them in this emotional, this existential distress, as well as the real pain and suffering that they're going through. And it's my contention that these patients, when they're so desperate, if we sit down and take the time to tease out all these factors in their request, and many times they're ambivalent about their request to die. They ask it, but when you start to probe more deeply into their request and you start to find out what they're really telling you, then if you can resolve some of their anxiety about certain of these issues, you're going to die around your loved ones. That may give them relief. You're going to die in your home. That may give them relief. You're going to die in not horrible pain because of our excellent pain control. If you can reassure these patients, then many times they'll withdraw their request for physician-assisted suicide. So some of the tools we have include supportive psychotherapy for these patients, which is much better than it was 5 to 10 years ago. Antidepressant medicine. We have great palliative care now. We're much better able to control pain. And then we have this whole new area that Professor Heffler mentioned called palliative sedation. Palliative sedation is a way, it's a technique that one uses, especially if someone is having uncontrollable pain or much in the way of psychological pain, anxiety, depression, that you can actually sedate them either to bare consciousness or unconsciousness, but you don't hasten their death. You relieve their sense of pain and suffering, and then they die. And usually it's associated with withdrawing food and water from them. So lastly, just to conclude, a good death, as I see it, is one where the patient is at home, they're surrounded by loved ones, They're receiving appropriate palliative care, including pain care, but dealing with simple things, their constipation, their nausea, their vomiting, their depression, their anxiety, and that hopefully they're being tended to by a personal physician who's known them for a long time, who can be there for them at the end. And you focus on not the patients dying, but they're living, they celebrate their life. You help them with short-term goals, getting to their granddaughter's graduation, celebrating a birthday, etc. That's a good death. A bad death is away from home, not surrounded by loved ones, and by a physician who really doesn't know you, who doesn't, I don't think, have the compassion that a long-term physician can. There's much more I can say. We can talk later about the problem areas that we sometimes fall down on as physicians, but I think I'll stop right there.
I, too, would like to thank the Clark Forum for putting this program together and to thank you coming out to hear these issues. As a hospice nurse, and I've been a hospice nurse for a long time, and even though I'm retired, that's a part of me that will still go on and that I still care very deeply about. Hospice has the philosophy that we do not prolong life, nor do we hasten the ending of that life. And as Dr. Lewis alluded to, we focus as a hospice on first looking at this patient. I don't know, probably with all the information that's out there about hospice, many of you know, but I'll just share a few facts, that hospice is a program for terminally ill patients who have been told that they have 6 months or less to live. Obviously, there is no one that knows the life of a person, how long that person has to live. But the way of hospice is to focus on the living part and living till you die. And I believe if I could sum it up in a sentence, I would say that dying is a part of living. It's rarely wanted. It's never easy. It's very hard. But it's a time of living. And I think, as I was sharing this evening before we came over, that the one thing that I have learned from my hospice patients is how to live each day to the fullest. And I believe Dr. Lewis also alluded to the fact that many times patients, the people you're dealing with as they're facing end of life, is trying to have them verbalize to us, what do you want? You know, what is important to you? And having a family connection there, I have found many times, is very important. It's not easy to see your mother, your dad, your child needing massive amounts of care, changing diapers, you know, those personal things that we've taken care of as adults, and now we're put back into that stage of where we need somebody doing that for us. But it's also a time that I found with all of my hospice families, a rewarding time. I'm not saying it's easy. Hospice families have an awesome job to do. You know, it's a 24-hour, 7 days a week job. And they're the ones doing it. It's not the nurse, hospice nurse coming in. They're the ones that are there all the time doing it. So not every family can do that. But our job as hospice workers is to support those families that want to go on this journey with their loved one, to be a part of that. As I was going through my nursing career, I little dreamed that I would ever get to this point of working with dying patients and to feel, if you want to say comfortable with that. I don't know that you can ever feel comfortable with someone dying, but I do believe that my mother and her death and my caring for her taught me and put that desire within me to do what I'm doing and what I was doing today and still will do. It's not over as a hospice nurse. You just don't ever cut it off. But My mother was diagnosed with colon cancer and only lived 4 months after that. And at the time, 1 month prior to her death, her cancer had spread throughout her body, to her brain, to her lungs, to her bones. And yet, even back then, and that was in 1975, we were fortunate enough to have a physician who looked at us as not just looking at the patient, but looking at the whole family as a unit and helping us work through issues and assuring us that he would be there for us night or day, that his pledge to us was that he would take care of her and that she would not be in excruciating pain. And I think that then started my journey in my profession as a nurse to do that for other families, to help other families. As I said, we as a hospice team do look at that whole unit, and we do come as a team. I'm not just that one person involved in the care of that patient. Our team consists of the physician who refers that patient to us, the nurse, a social worker, an aide, nurse's aide that can go in and help with bathing and those personal things, volunteers that go and give that family some break time, some respite time, because you can't do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You need some break time out. And our chaplain, who is not there just as that, you know, not a specific religion, but to be there for that spiritual support for that patient and family. And as I journeyed through my career, and as people, the patients involved in my life then, taught me, I can clearly say that I only had one lady who said, I went to her house one day and she said, hey, you know that Dr. K, that person, you know, I want to talk to him. I want you to go call him. I want to talk to him. So as we've talked about here today, it's important to get to the reason of why someone wants to do that. And it's not my right to judge that, although I do believe in dignity of life, sanctity of life. And I would be that hospice nurse in Carol's situation that couldn't participate in that. Yeah. But it wouldn't mean that I cared any less for that patient or that family. So as I talked with her, we actually went out and onto her daughter's patio. There was trees around, and we sat there and we talked for a long time. And her biggest fear was that she would die alone, and she would die in pain. And she felt she would be a burden to her daughter. She only had the one daughter, and that it would be a burden. So we talked about for a long time, and I promised her, number one, that she would not be alone, that there would, you know, we were just a phone call away, and if need be, we would be camping out at her house. And number two, that with the medications that were even available then, and this was 10 years ago, that we would control her pain, that she would not have to die in pain. I think the greatest fear that I hear or heard from many of my patients was not knowing what was going to happen. And I can't tell you, I wouldn't even begin to tell you how either one, any of you here would die. But I would hope that there would be those caring physicians and that team to be there with you, to support you, and to, you know, support your family, and to help address some of these issues. Physician-assisted suicide, and we talked about, was legal in Oregon, and that was the first state. And as I was thinking about that and pulling off some information, it said that by the end of 2003, 171 individuals had ended their life with the help of lethal prescriptions. The number appears to be leveling off at fewer than 50 assisted suicides per year. Physician-assisted suicide under the Act accounts for only 1/7 of 1% of all deaths in the state. I'm not here to argue that. I'm just here to say that we need to be, as the medical profession, better at dealing with death and dying. And Dr. Lewis alluded to the fact that there have been improvements in pain management, but there still needs to be more. There still needs to be more education of physicians. Back a few years ago, the medical colleges and the professors there would say, but we don't have time to teach all of that. You know, it would take probably another year or 2 years for that physician to be in school before we could really get all that in. And so that was an easy way out, I think. It doesn't matter if it takes 5 years or 6 years or 8 years. There needs to be better education of these physicians and nurses who are involved in the journey to the end of life. I don't know it all. I appreciate Jim saying an expert, but I'm certainly not the expert. But I do have a caring and compassion for those who are terminally ill, who are facing end of life. There will always be debates, I think, of the pros and cons. But I hope that more than that, that we can see improvement in end of life care. And we've talked about sedation, palliative care. There's the other term that floats around is terminal sedation. And there's all kind of issues out there. But I think until we look at the core of what's going on with that patient and that family and how can we address those needs, then I think the care will improve and we'll see people probably less likely asking for physician-assisted suicides to take place. I also went researching because when somebody puts a challenge out to me, I love then to go researching to see what I can find out. And actually, right now, Pennsylvania has a bill that's going through the judicial system. It's in the department that they're looking at for physician-assisted suicide. I don't know when that will come about, if it'll even come about. Probably will get voted down in this state. But there are a lot of other states acting on that. And again, I go back to we need to really look and find out what's, you know, the issues with this patient and this family. My dad, I share with you, is 99 years old and lives by himself in Georgia. And is very adamant about the fact that he's going to live and he's going to outlive all his kids. And I dare say he probably will, the way it's going. But within that, you know, even for people who are terminally ill, there is that desire. As Dr. Lewis alluded to, they have their wishes. And the one lady that particularly comes to my mind is a lady who was told that she only had 3 weeks to live. And we took her home with oxygen and those kind of things, and her desire was to see her granddaughter get married. And her granddaughter was getting married in Pittsburgh. So as a hospice team, we put together, with the doctor's help, getting oxygen arranged for her, finding a special van that the wheelchair could go into, arranging for oxygen to be available for her in Pittsburgh if her tanks ran out. And this lady was so driven to see her granddaughter get married, she went to the wedding. She came back to the hotel room because she was too tired to go to the reception, and she died that night in her hotel room. But she accomplished that wish, you know. And it's amazing how when people set their minds to have that particular goal, what they will do to achieve that goal, and to have a hospice team available to help her achieve that goal. I think, as I said, that medical educators tend to whine a little bit, not only in educating physicians, but nurses as well, about not having that time to teach all that the doctors need to know. But my fear would be that if we go physician-assisted suicide route, we don't have physicians that know how to do it right either, you know. And my fear would be that we aren't hearing, because it's not legal here in Pennsylvania, we're not hearing reports about the things that do go wrong. And I know there were some studies out from the Netherlands that indicated that just because it's planned doesn't mean that it always goes right. There are complications to that as well. So I think it's far better, from the way I feel, is that with our voices and our votes, we need to say, fine, take the time that it's required to do and make sure that people are given that opportunity to live till they die.
You got it all. We're going to take some questions now. If you want to raise your hand, and we'll bring a microphone around. One thing I'll say, just as we're getting ready to take the first question, morphine, as you may or may not know, it's not only used to manage pain. Morphine, as in the case of this woman, can alleviate sense of air hunger. When the hospital weans people off a respirator, you can provide morphine, and that decreases that sense of suffocation and so forth. Going to what Dr. Lewis and Linda Smith said with regard to use of morphine and being very good at it, there's a tremendous difference across the 50 states in per capita use of morphine. Tremendous difference, meaning some people are using it very sparingly, other people using it very generously. Has anybody got any idea what state in the country is by far and away the highest user of morphine per capita?
Oregon.
Because one of the reasons that patients or physicians have gotten really good at that there, because the alternative is legal, assisted suicide. And so they've gotten very good, and the education level of palliative care in Oregon, I would argue, is bar none better than anywhere in the country. So that's something to give, you know, something to think about, too. Questions?
A 100 years ago, extended issues of dying 200 years ago were not an issue. It seems that this is an issue of advances in medical science and other technology, but it seems that society's ethics have not kept up with the changes in science. Could you comment on that, any of the members of the panel? What do we do to bring our ethics in line with our advances in technology and science?
That sounds like a Dr. Lewis to me.
Oh, that's not an easy one. I think their whole books, whole curricula, address that topic, and Professor Effler has written books about that topic, so he's probably the expert. But I can tell you that when you died or when you had a serious illness 150, 200, 300 years ago, it was God's will. You lived a good life. Everyone around you died about the same age, 45, 50 years old. Your expectations were not high. God had a role for you in life. God brought you into the world, and God would take you out in his time. So certainly one of the many factors that have changed over the last 100 or 150 years is the change in one's, I think, belief in God and their religious values. But number two, it is the advance in technology, medical technology. When you hear on Good Morning America that they can do facial transplants, you know? I want a facial transplant. When you hear that so-and-so was on a respirator, 3 years and then came off, they were no longer in a coma, they woke up, said hello to their family, and got on with their life. Your expectations are totally changed. And so there's all sorts of conflict in aspects of living and dying. And it's been brought about culturally by violence and TV. I mean, it's changed our expectations. I think we see a lot of suffering in third world countries. We watch TV and see people dying in Darfur, you know, things like that, and starvation. And it really gives you, do you want to live in a world where millions of people are dying of starvation? It, you know, they weren't watching TV 150 years ago. They didn't know what was out there. So there are so many cultural and medical changes that have, that you're right, have changed and confused how we think about living and dying. And there's not been any one person smart enough to incorporate all those changes and say, well, here's the obvious way out of this dilemma. It's not there. There's just so much information we have to process, I think.
Well, before antibiotics, people did, I believe, they died quicker deaths. They got a bacterial infection and died, you know, in 2 weeks they were dead, or they had a heart attack. And now because of, you know, all the medicine, they do live longer. But I know that my mother, when she was a little girl, 80 years ago, her mother was reading in the newspaper and talking to her grandmother about, oh, here's another case of a man, or I don't know if it was a man or a woman, helping their loved one to die. You know, and I'm not sure. And they were, you know, had been arrested for it and was being tried for it. So it's not really a new thing, the ethical issue about this. During the trial, I got a letter, it was delivered right to the courtroom because it was on TV in Europe, and she had watched my testimony, and a woman in England just had to tell her story to me, that she put a pillow over her mother's head in the hospital and got away with it. So I know it happens.
Hi. My question has to do with advanced directives, and do you see that it's just a matter of time until an advanced directive is made towards physician-assisted suicide, or and if so, because that had a lot to do with it took time until do not resuscitate advanced directives got passed into law. If so, do you think it's a lot easier to have an advanced directive when that patient is competent, or do you think it's a lot easier to decide legally after the fact, when they're mentally incapacitated, whether or not to go ahead and do physician-assisted suicide?
Well, I mean, one of the basic tenets of bioethics is patient autonomy. The patient has to make the decision. You don't wait till they'd be near death and when they can't make the decision and try to make it for them. I mean, the patient has to decide what they want to do, or their surrogate has to decide, or the courts have to decide the course of action if someone is near terminal. But as far as the state has an interest in keeping people alive, now that, for many reasons, but as someone approaches death, they have less of an interest in keeping a patient alive, but still, it's going to be a governmental issue, either a state or a national issue, of whether physician-assisted suicide ever gets to be on an advanced directive. My guess is no, it mm-hmm. won't. And in fact, I can tell you, there are studies in the Netherlands that when physicians are given additional education in palliative care and end-of-life care, the requests for physician-assisted suicide have gone down as physicians have gotten better doing it.
And it's true. Physician-assisted suicide is not something that somebody can choose in advance and then become incompetent. And the data does suggest about 8% of patients in the Netherlands 2 years ago, 8% chose either euthanasia or assisted suicide. That number is down to 5%. Mm-hmm. The percentage of patients choosing palliative sedation is increased by the same amount. So this is what's happening, knowledge and experience and education and palliative care is getting better. And palliative care to the point of, you know, well, we just can't give any more, and so you're just going to have to suffer with what we got, pushing that limit on into unconsciousness, which is troubling for some. But being able to push into that barrier of unconsciousness has really dropped requests for assisted suicide and euthanasia.
But I think his question, though, is more about being able to say in advance if you become unconscious, right, or unable to, and, you know, nowhere, I don't know of any place that you know, Oregon, certainly you have to be the person making the request in a sound, you know, you have to be mentally competent. But I would think, you know, that may not ever have to occur because we still, you can pull the plug, right? Most of those people are on life support, right? If, yeah. Or not stop, you know, stop feeding.
My question is more related to the controversy that Susan Kenning was trying to figure out what that person wanted. And if that person says in advance, why do we get to that
point? Right. Well, by definition, assisted suicide means somebody assists you in suicide. If you're incompetent, you can't do it, then that's not assisted suicide. That's euthanasia, and we're a million light years away from that, I think.
And I think, too, Jim, that, you know, the point is that you need to talk to your loved ones about what your wishes are. You know, when I started in hospice work, very few people made advance directives, made their wishes known. And, you know, today there's living wills, and you can make your wishes known. In fact, our son was up visiting this past weekend, and I had him be aware where my living will is, and I have a copy ready for him so that if something should happen with my husband, that he's not able to make decisions for me. They know what my wishes are. And, you know, I hear people struggling, families struggling, saying, well, I don't know what my loved one wants. We never talked about what to do if something happened, you know, or, if, you know, if to take the plug, you know, turn the machine off. To do that. So I think it's important that we talk about it and let our loved ones know what our wishes are regarding when we're in that terminal state.
Ben?
It's been my experience. I've had many, many occasions to be called, an invitation to talk with people who are in the position to make that decision we're talking about. And I've done that many, many times. And there's almost a pattern, not a pattern. But the most important thing in the beginning is to know that the person who's making the decision is in a good position to make that decision. That's the, I think the crucial thing is to help them reach the point, not by direction, but by working together with them, trying to understand so that they can have a good idea. Because in many, many occasions, the person who is making the decision is a person who's not capable of making many decisions. Mm-hmm. And if you can help that person, and it may take a period of time to make that decision, it's the thing that you do. And there are persons living today, living very well, that had decided at that particular time that they didn't want to live. And I would say the major thing, their inability at that particular time to make a good decision. And then the other thing that you find over a period of time is that people take different ways. You think in a way that it's a 15 second or 5 minutes. I've seen people take a good deal of time and use different devices, some of them not immediate. Things as alcohol, drugs, these are used for the same purpose. And it takes a while. I remember my first experience back about 1934. With a young man. His sister I knew, and he was about 30. He was the assistant treasurer of a large utility, doing very well, married a wonderful girl, good girl, came home one night and she was in bed with another man. Changed his life completely. A year later, after a whole life. He'd go to work every day, come home every day, and then go to a bar and drink until you have to find him, take him home. And we went through this. And after one year, I found that I had to take him to the hospital, and he died there. And he was the first person doctor that I saw liquid come out of his eyes. Mm. And he had set out to do that, and he had consisted. You can attempt to do everything, but it's a different thing. It's not in every case, every time I've been with somebody, it's different. Mm. They're never the
That's
same.
True.
But thank you.
Thank you.
Is he a physician? Is that what he said?
No, he's a retired psychology professor.
This is going to sound a little harsh. I don't mean it to. I greatly appreciate the topic, and I greatly appreciate what's being done for people at end of life. But both Dr. Lewis and Ms. Smith, when you talked about people dying, you talked about patients dying rather than people dying. And as long as we refer to them as patients, then the authority, the arbiter of whether or not they can die is the physician or the nurse. And it seems to me that the decision is made in an ideal case by the person, him or herself, and their family. And I just wonder, actually, what is my question? My question is, how can we return, how can we have physician-assisted suicide but leave the decision in the hands of the person and the family?
You know, I guess part of the answer to that is the family and the patient have to make the decision, but you can't truly make a decision unless you've been totally informed, what I feel is accurately, about a whole host of factors for which you can make the decision. So you have to be, we call that process in medicine informed consent. You have to be given informed consent of your diagnosis, your prognosis, but more than that, you have to enter in this dialogue with the family about what their fears are, like I mentioned, why they're suffering, and you try to help with them work through some of their fears. Now, if after that whole process, they decide that they still want to have assistance in suicide, then I can't change their mind. But I guess what a lot of studies show is once you go through that process, a lot of people back off because you've reassured them and you've soothed their mind, relieved a lot of their fears. But but the final decision is not mine on that. It's the patient's.
There was a gentleman in the Old Testament by the name of Job who had 10 of his children killed, all of his property seized, and then he was struck with boils from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. The Bible says that he feared God. He was in such pain, his wife suggested to him that he curse God and die. Job said, "Blessed be the name of the Lord. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." The position of the Christian church from the beginning has ever been that life is a gift from God, and only God has the right to take life. The sixth commandment says, "Thou shalt not kill." Suicide is self-murder. Now, it is true, there are people who lose all hope and it happens and it's a tragedy. It is the legitimate role of a state or a government to preserve life and property. Our Fifth Amendment says in part of the United States Constitution, "No person shall be denied of life, liberty, or property."
How do you explain more?
Without due process of law. Okay.
How do you explain more?
Could we get to a question?
Yeah, my question is this. I was down at Pinellas Park when Terry Schiavo was deliberately starved to death. The lawyer who represented Mike Schiavo, the husband, to have her put to death, is now the third in command in the Department of Justice. I think the move for euthanasia is getting much closer to us than we like to admit. That speaks volumes.
Are you an anti-war activist, too?
There is legitimate war to defend life and property.
What about starvation in Darfur? Are you working on that, too?
I think we're going to... Let's go to another
question.
Excuse
me.
We have another question?
I imagine that it's really hard to find some common ground sometimes between the physician and the family. Like, if the family might be a little more aggressive than they should be, they don't know what's best for the patient. So as like a physician, how do you, or as a hospice nurse, how do you find, like, how do you separate your beliefs for what should happen to the patient from what the family believes if maybe they want them to live longer than they should?
So let me just have understand, how as a physician or a nurse do we separate our own personal beliefs from what is best for the patient? Did you say that?
Okay. Like one question, if say the physician is a religious person and they believe that it should let God take care of the person's life, then well, that's my first one, I guess. How do you separate your own beliefs from what you believe should happen for the patient?
You know, it's a great question, and I can tell you no one in any profession or in any relationship can totally separate their own beliefs and be totally objective when they talk to a patient, but we try to. And so we try to understand the values, the core values of the patients and the family. And we, at least I hope other physicians do too, you try to recognize the core values of the patients you're dealing with. And if they are so diametrically opposed to mine that ethically, I can withdraw from the case. If they say, I just want to talk about physician-assisted suicide, of course, I'll try to go into it in more detail with them. But if they say, I only want you, Dr. Lewis, to give me a prescription for barbiturates, and if it really, depending on the case or the issue or something, I'm diametrically opposed, of course, I can withdraw from the case and they can get another physician. But for most cases, they're not like that. You recognize the core values, and you try to work with their values. If they're religious, you bring in a minister, a priest, a rabbi to work with them. If they're socially, psychosocially isolated, and they have a sister that lives in a West Coast, you know, who can help them make these tough decisions, we'll try to get the sister in from the West Coast. We'll work with the patients. So, I mean, the answer is, on occasion, we'll walk away, but we'll try to get help for the patient, but sometimes we can't help them. But most of the time, we work with them, try to help them resolve whatever their issues are.
We have time for one more question.
I wanted to direct this question to Ms. Smith.
Okay.
I know that one of the biggest arguments that people looking for assisted suicide say is that, or that people talking about it say that they feel like they're not in control of what's going to happen, and there's an argument that says that it would help hospice care if euthanasia was allowed, because then people would feel safer in the fact that they had a choice to make pertaining to their life, and even though they might not choose euthanasia, that just knowing that they have that choice would make them feel better. I just wanted to know how you felt about that sort of argument.
Okay. I think knowing that the nurses and the doctors have medications available, and again, I think to start out with saying that individual we need to talk to know to understand them, to help understand what their fears are, you know, what family resources are available out there. I dare say that any one of us in here tonight can commit suicide if they so choose. You don't need me to help you do that. The resources are certainly out there. But I, as a hospice nurse and a nurse that believes in the sanctity of life and believes as well that God is the one in control of that, I would have to withdraw myself from that case and, you know, offer that patient someone who would support that. But again, I think it goes back to, with education of the physicians and the treatment of symptoms, be there pain symptoms, you know, whatever symptoms are disturbing to that patient, and delving into providing that psychological support And as you alluded to, many times those patients who are thinking about suicide, euthanasia, are going through those periods of depression. And I dare say that those people, those individuals are not being treated as well, you know, treating that depression. I don't know if that's getting to, you know, what you're asking, but certainly I would not like to see that brought into fruition, that law would be in place.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, I would like to thank our panelists and moderator. I would also like to remind you of the informal discussion taking place in room 102 next door. And this concludes tonight's program. Thank you for coming and have a good evening.